If you would turn with me to John chapter 5, and the things that we must consider in this passage, in particular from verse 16 through to 30, the things that we must consider are perhaps gathered together quite effectively in verse 21. Let me just remind you, let us take our reminder of what Jesus is saying by turning for a moment to read again verse 21, where he says, "For as the Father raises the dead and gives life to them, even so the Son gives life to whom he will." The story thus far, as we read at the beginning and as we have looked at previously, is that Jesus had come to Jerusalem and visited that special pool, Bethesda, that pool where people would come, flock to come and get healing for their illnesses, although perhaps amongst the multitude there might have been those spectators who were just looking to watch something spectacular. Perhaps we see Jesus coming to this pool. I suspect when we read that he knew that this man had been ill for a long time, that he'd been lying there in that condition, it's quite possible that Jesus may have seen him on previous visits to Jerusalem. But there we read that Jesus comes to this place. One of his special interests in much of his own work, John hints at it, we read more fully of it in the other Gospels, about the way that Jesus went about doing a great deal of healing. But on this occasion, he gave special attention to one man and then disappeared. He asked this man back in verse 6, "Do you want to be made well?" And then he made him well with a word, "Rise, take up your bed and walk," in verse 8. That's all it took on this occasion. But what stretches this story further and into very important instruction by the Lord himself is that all of this happened on the Sabbath, a day which God had made holy, has made holy, but which the Jews by that time had made heavy. They had imposed many tight rules and regulations on how this day was to be observed. And one of the regulations was a prohibition on carrying things any distance. And in fact, the detail is not to carry it from one, it was called domain, to another. So that perhaps if he'd just kept on walking all day around that pool with his bed under his arm, it might not have been an issue. So it's that kind of situation. But he'd taken it out, headed for the temple, it seems. So when this man followed Jesus' directive, that's what it was, walk was part of the direction, the instruction, he found himself the object of the attention of the authorities. You might call them the religious police, the Jews, as John frequently calls them. And so his answer was to avoid the blame and say it's his fault, the one who made me well, this unknown healer. When Jesus does approach him again a bit later on, in verse 14, he found him in the temple. After that, the man seems to have found out who this man, who his healer was, and he went and told the Jews that it was Jesus, continuing to deflect the attention from himself. Here's the one you need to be complaining to. And so they duly did, and we read very abruptly that it's for this reason in verse 16 that the Jews persecuted Jesus and sought to kill him. Why is this? Well, we have the answers. There are some issues that they take with Jesus, and then we need to also see the issue that Jesus takes with them. As we do so, as we look through here, I would suggest that we need to pay a little attention to the Sabbath issue. But that's not all that there is to this. Very quickly, it moves to the sonship issue. And then we need to consider, in relation to that, the work that God does. And inevitably, as with all the gospel, what is the response to Jesus in the light of this? And so we're looking at the Sabbath issue, the sonship issue, the work that God does, and the response to Jesus of what you do, what men did then, and what you do in response to him. So to look first then at the Sabbath issue. This breaking of the Sabbath was quite obvious to the Jews in their understanding. They had these very complicated guidelines, one of which I've mentioned. In other places, we read that they objected to precisely to Jesus' healing on the Sabbath, but that's not the particular point here. The point is that they objected to the man carrying his bed. Just by the way, the bed is not quite like the ones that we're familiar with, as you can probably imagine. It's more like a bed roll that they rolled up, a mattress, something that could be picked up and carried with them. And usually, because in the home, that would have to be laid out at night to sleep on and then rolled up to be stowed away, as many cultures still need to do. But there are all sorts of odd things about this, I think. One is that Jesus himself didn't count this bed-carrying as a sin. He told the man to do it on the Sabbath. He didn't count it as a sin. It was his instruction. There's also that the man himself seems to have been almost blind to the incredible transformation that's taken place in his own life by a word. This man who healed me, all he was concerned about was to avoid the fine or the penalty that the authorities were going to impose on him. He was more interested in that than proclaiming. There are others that we read about who just could not be stopped from talking about this person who had healed them. They were desperate to do it, regardless of the consequences. But oddest of all, I think, is that it's much the same for the Jews themselves. Here was this man that they must have known had been there for over 30 years, and here he was, no longer slumped by the pool, but walking about, indeed carrying something. And they give no attention to this. All they're concerned about is that here is a person carrying something on the Sabbath, and we need to deal with that problem, as they read it. In his answer, the man does make reference. He said, "He who made me well." He's pointing them to that. He's saying, don't forget, you're talking about this bedroll under my arm, but don't forget, I've actually been made well. Don't you have anything to say about that? On this occasion, they didn't. It's striking, I think. It's quite peculiar. But they take no notice. There's something else that's preoccupying. Something incredible has happened, a miracle. The word of God, which they were not ready to recognize, but that word has come and it has healed a man, restored him by that word. And so what do these people do? They see it, they don't stop and say, what's happened to you? How come you're walking? You've been there for 38 years. What's happened? Let's go and rejoice about it. Instead of that, their focus is entirely on the transgression of their precious regulations. They were blind to this spiritual victory. It is a spiritual victory. Perhaps not so much a transformation of this man's heart, although Jesus comes back to it and commands him to sin no more to bring about a full transformation. But let's just observe this for a moment, because it is something that is constant in man's response to God. We will take notice of a man's unsophisticated or confused theology, but forget to give credit that he is a courageous evangelist who goes where I might not dare to. We may look, and people do look, and have constantly looked, and these days there are battles over looking at someone's too formal or incorrect arrangements for worship and church services, while being blind to the presence of God's Spirit bringing true worship, whatever the setting might be. We frown and we grumble over someone's fumbling work for Christ and her neighbor, and fail to see her loving and generous heart for all the mistakes that we might notice. we bear with a poor speaker or preacher, failing to get to grips with what he's trying to lay in front of us. The great and the glorious gospel of salvation in Christ Jesus. We need to beware of the spirit of the Jews. It's not far from any one of us. Just not seeing the great things right in front of us. They took issue over the Sabbath. What happens next? Jesus has an answer for this. What do we have to understand by this answer? He answers that there is a place for a certain kind of work on the Sabbath. It was so restricted in their interpretation. But he says, there is a place, and my Father has been doing it. Has been doing it. No beginning, no end. Or rather, a beginning in creation, at least. This is something that I think the Jews understood. The work of God on the Sabbath. We read back in Genesis chapter 1 that God created the heavens and the earth in 6 days, and on the seventh day in chapter 2 he rested and made the day holy. But God has never rested the way we think of, not that horizontal recreation. God has been at work from the moment he created this world, in the work of providence, in upholding this universe that he has made. If you want to know what you can do on Sundays, the Christian Sabbath, the Christian weekly rest and celebration day, ask yourself what the Father in heaven does, what he's been doing since he created this world. His works of preservation and provision, works of mercy. The Jews knew that God didn't stop working once those 6 days of creation were done. They didn't think that he stopped working one day in seven. They knew that this world would not continue except that God was constantly at work in providence. That work of providence in, as the Catechism puts it, wisdom, holiness, and power, preserving and governing all his creatures and all their actions. But you see, it's because of this knowledge that they knew that he could only be talking about God himself. It's because of this that they went on to persecute him all the more in verse 18. This was his answer, why he had done these things on the Sabbath, why he had healed a man and told him to carry his bed. It's because Jesus says, there's someone who has been working right through. You know who he is. This is the way you understand that God has been about things. He does work on the Sabbath, right through every day. And he's my Father. That's where the connection is made. This man, to all appearances as Jesus was, he answered their challenge about working on the Sabbath. He, as it were, to them, excused what he was doing by saying he was doing what was equal to the work of God. He was going on in the same vein. That's who they understood when he said, my Father has been working until now. They knew that he meant God in heaven. But for them, for him then to claim that that gave him the right to go on to do this work, and in fact to go and say, I have been working in harness with God himself, in the same terms with which God has been working, this was not allowed. And so that's where the sonship issue arises. The Sabbath issue is dealt with in more detail in other places, in other records that we have. But it moves on from that in this case because there is something even bigger still that they have to contend with. They recognize, as it tells us in verse 18, he said not just that he broke the Sabbath by their reckoning, but he also said that God was his Father, thus making himself equal with God. How could it be otherwise? It's worth noting, I think, that this was the immediate reaction of the Jews. This is the way they heard it, as it hit their ears when he said, my Father. But this was God, and he was a man as far as they could see, he was a man claiming to be the Son of God. The Jews resisted this because they were careful to insist that, according to Moses teaching them in Deuteronomy 6, that the Lord our God, the Lord is one. And that was one thing that the people of Israel had struggled to get to grips with for generations and centuries. But by this time the Jews had it. They had a grip on this fact that God is one and there is only one God to worship. That was their problem all through the years, that they had gone after other gods. Now they have it. And what do they find? As to them, it's under attack, as it probably had been on a number of occasions, not just in this one. They realized that when anyone claimed that God was their own particular father, my father, it was a claim for equality with God. How could it be otherwise when there is one God? And as we read on, far from denying that that's what he meant, Jesus firmly holds on to precisely that meaning. He develops it and its implications. So it is that that issue of the Sabbath had to take a back seat. This matter has to be resolved first. In their minds, it is resolved, of course. It is the way things are. It is true. But until men come to grips with this, other things do have to wait and take a back seat. Nothing will be understood unless this is understood. That's John's great concern and objective in the Gospel, to show us that this Jesus is the Son of God. Why does John do it? It's because that is what we see right in front of us, that that's what Jesus sought to establish amongst men. That is the crucial issue. That is what matters most. Do you believe Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God? Only then, by believing in him as the Son of God, only then can life altogether make sense. And it's so therefore it's this that Jesus goes on to speak of with these people. This is what they were most resistant to. And Jesus doesn't shy clear. He steps into it and presents to them the truth. He does go on in the next part after this, from verse 31, to talk about the witnesses to him being the Son of God, and God willing we'll be able to move on to that the next time. But this is the issue, this is what he's above all concerned about presenting to them. If anything, this should have been a very strongly reassuring message that the Jews were given. That's how they should have heard it. See the kind of thing that Jesus told them in verse 19, for example. Most assuredly, this is a very strong statement. This is the truth. In the old version, it was verily, verily, truly, truly, I say to you. And this should be reassuring. Here is a man who is claiming to be the Son of God, and he says, but don't worry about it, because I'm not going to do anything that is different from what the Father does. The Son can do nothing of himself but what he sees the Father do. For whatever he does, the Father, the Son also does in like manner. Don't be afraid of this. The Son is coming, but he's going to do precisely what God does. That's what he's all about. They should have been reassured. There are many who claim to be Messiah, many who will claim to be Messiah, many who claim to be Son of God. And I'm sure sad experience had taught them that they'd be led up all kinds of strange paths by these people. But Jesus is insisting, I'm going to do nothing different from what you know of God. Well, except to open him up more truly. Jesus laid himself open to the tests that were taught by Moses regarding prophets. There are other things that Jesus fulfilled, but the prophets was the first thing, the thing that was up in front of the people. Back in Deuteronomy 18, which we will touch on this evening, God willing. There, if a man comes with a prophecy, you wait to see if that prophecy is fulfilled. And if it is, you can rely upon his word. What does Jesus do? He says, things will be happening. Things are going to go on. In the second part For example, he says, "The hour is coming," in verse 25, "and now is, when the dead will hear the voice of the Son of God, and those who hear will live." Later on, he says, there is an hour coming when all who are in the graves will hear his voice. That is still to be fulfilled, I believe. But the first one, within his own lifetime. This is chapter 5, in verse 11, we read of a dead man hearing the voice of the Son of God and living. Lazarus. There were others who heard his voice as well. Within the lifetime of these very people, they could hear a prophet say, "This is what will happen. I am the Son of God, the Son of God, myself. I will speak to dead men, and you will see them live." They could tell that his word was true in the most impossible situation. So what about the rest? That's what Moses said. You will know that his word is true, this prophet, when his words come true. And it's with this in view that Jesus continues to reassure and to explain what it is that he's about. That's why that particular prophecy is so important in this context. What he is about, how could it be anything other than God at work among men? It is about giving life. This is the work of the Father. As the Father raises the dead, verse 21, and gives life to them, even so the Son gives life to whom he will. Life is in the Father, verse 26. So he has granted the Son to have life in himself. That's what it's all about. That's the primary work of God amongst men, is to give life, new life, and to do that life-giving through Jesus. This is the work that God does, Father and Son. This is John's preoccupation. It should be ours. Isn't that the way he begins the Gospel? Back in chapter 1, it was the word that was with God, the word that was God. All things were made through him. That was the giving of life. In him was life. Right at the very beginning, it tells us that. Right at the very end, he has told us that his purpose in writing this is that you may believe that this Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you may have life in his name. This is the theme running from beginning to end of John's Gospel, because it's the theme of Jesus' life. Giving of life unto men. That's what God himself is about. With that, we also read that something that's introduced, if you like, in this place. There is that word of life and leading people to live, bringing people to live. But along with that, there's something else. It's the message of judgment. Verse 21, which we took as our text today, the Father raises the dead and gives life to them. Even so, the Son gives life to whom he will. And then an explanation of what this is all about. In verse 22, "For the Father judges no one, but has committed all judgment to the Son." What is this about? How does this work? Why is he saying this? Judgment was never clearly related in quite the same way to the Messiah in the Old Testament. But what is very clear in the Old Testament is that judgment is in God's hands. And judgment is very closely related to life and death. It cannot be otherwise. Even we, I think, can see the logic in that. Again, through Moses, Deuteronomy 32, 39, God said, "Now see that I, even I, am he, and there is no God besides me. I kill and I make alive. I wound and I heal, nor is there any who can deliver from my hand." Life and death are only in God's hands, no one else's. And that is an issue of God's judgment upon men, as is a constant theme through the Old Testament. Jesus now brings it together by saying, this is what God is doing. God offers life. But in the face of that offer, when men reject it, it brings judgment the other way. As Jesus brings life and judgment together in this chapter, it's really no more than another way of announcing his authority over life and death, which he has said in those words in this passage, that he does have this authority. And one part of this without the other is a nonsense, as is any other part of life when we don't think of this particular issue. What's the point of fussing over all the stuff of life when you don't have life itself sorted out? Isn't that the big question for every one of us? All the people out there that we say don't hear about the message of Christ. Yes, for them, but for you and me too. Isn't there an awful lot of stuff in our homes, in our lives, in our hearts? And we're preoccupied with that. It's not just about the beginning of life, it's about the pursuit of life and all that Christ would take us into. What's the point when you don't have life sorted? There are many who will make reference to God in some kind of token of honoring of him. But this passage tells us you cannot honor God unless you honor the Son. He is the way and the life. In verse 23, this is all so that all should honor the Son just as they honor the Father. He who does not honor the Son does not honor the Father who sent him. You don't believe in God, the true God, unless you believe in Jesus Christ. You don't know God and therefore have eternal life unless you know Jesus Christ whom he sent. Not true knowledge of God. Not true believing. It all hinges on the Son. The Son who does what God does, no more and no less. So the question is, the response. Do you honor him? Do you honor the Father who sent him? Doesn't he say that there are those who will hear his voice and do as he says? Down in verses 28 and 29, who are those people who will hear his voice and honor him by doing as he says? It's the dead. We confess that we believe in the resurrection from the dead. We confess we believe that this Christ has ascended to the right hand of the Father and will come again to judge the living and the dead. Here were the Jews who did not want to hear his voice. He says the hour is coming in which all who are in the graves will hear his voice and come forth. It will happen. Not one person will avoid it, be able to avoid it, not these Jews either. But then, of course, the matter will be settled. It depends on whether you have done good, you will find resurrection of life. Those who have done evil, to the resurrection of condemnation. It is Jesus who says this. We need to bear in mind, not just the apostles or those who have sought to interpret Christ's life in the New Testament. Jesus, he says, there will be those who rise to the resurrection of life or the resurrection of condemnation. The matter will be settled. What is it to do good, to find the resurrection of life? Isn't it just as the Son himself, as he concludes this particular passage that we've been taking, I do not seek my own will, but the will of the Father who sent me. That's to do good. And in our case, the first thing of God's will for us is to believe in the one he sent. Unless we've done that, we cannot be in the will of the Father. But back in verse 24 again, most assuredly I say to you, he who hears my word and believes in him who sent me has everlasting life, and shall not come into judgment, but has passed from death into life, passed already from death into life. How do we respond to Jesus? How did the Jews respond to Jesus? How do men today respond? Is it impossible that Jesus, this man Jesus, is the Son of God? Many say it is. The Jews said it was. Many do say it is. Why should it be impossible when God is God? If you count that impossible, then you're not looking at the true God. But here is one whose word and his works do demonstrate the work of God and no other. When he does this, how will men respond to him? With the Jews, will men, will we, shut off the possibilities? It is a miraculous thing. This God, God's intervention in human history in this way. But that it's miraculous is not to say it's impossible. They mean completely different things. All it is saying is that it's unacceptable to human imagination. Where do we get our imagination from except what we know and have experienced? Terribly limited. Let's not be as the Jews in any way whatsoever, not even in a grain of our perception, though we may confess faith in him. There is that prophecy that Jesus made, laying it before men, opening himself to the test. Does he give life? Men could see. And you notice that when you come to chapter 11, and Lazarus did rise from the dead, even more the Jews sought to kill Jesus. This was getting desperate. They sought to kill Lazarus as well, to wipe out the evidence that this Jesus could bring life. As we go on and towards the end of this discourse of Jesus, through to verse 47, we find that with all this that Jesus has to say, with all his presentation in the next section of the witnesses to him, we find he comes to an end. And then the next chapter says he went over the Sea of Galilee. There's no answer from the people around him. They have shown no sign of relenting in their hostility, no sign of having heard what he has to say, no sign of having worked through even the logic of his answer. It does cross my mind, who did they think they were regarding themselves as the guardians of God's honor in this way? But it then crosses my mind that it's what most men do at some point or other in their lives, including you and me. The answer needs to be given by us too. You need to answer this once again. I think every day. Is this your faith? Are you advancing in this faith? Are you seeing more and more of what it is that Jesus can call God his Father? Jesus is not answered here except in the deadness of their hearing. They have not risen to this new life or light or understanding. But as I close, these Jews are long gone. Many, I was reading somebody saying just the other day, we live in the present. Past has happened and we need to take recognition of that, and we certainly do. We're part of this same race of man of which they were a part. They have long gone. They didn't answer Jesus. Are you going to answer him? Do you answer him? The day will come for every single one of us when we will hear and we will not be able to refuse his summons out of the grave. So I ask you again today, do you have this life through the Son? That's what he's about. This life can only be found in Jesus. Yes, it can only be found in God, but God sent his Son to give it to us. This is the way that this Father has appointed for us to find this life. If there's anyone here today who doesn't have that life, don't delay. how do you know what days he will give you? The Jews delayed, and what then? If you have found this new life, live it. Live it in him. There is no other way. Any other way that might try and take a hold of you, it's false and it's failing. But if you have this life, let this renew you in joy and gladness of his work amongst men. That this is the way that God has seen fit to deliver the knowledge of God amongst men. He has come. He's brought this knowledge. He has come to make known God in his glory. And he's come to bring us to God and to life in God. May God grant us then understanding of spirit that we might lay hold of him today. Let us pray together.